This is Channel 2 Riot and the continuation of the Tall Cap Supper on...
This is Channel 1 Riot. This is Channel 1 Riot. The beginning of the fifth reel, Barbara's fifth reel. And it's November the 18th after breakfast. November the 18th after breakfast. Channel 1 Riot.
I have a couple more on it.
Okay. Barbara's fifth reel, Channel 1 Right, Channel 1 Right, and it's after breakfast on November the 18th.
Tuesday.
And Tuesday, November the 18th. Five. Now, this is a little bit more about Pussy. She and I had a little bit of a set to yesterday afternoon. And I was out there, and I decided I'd work her in that ring, because she keeps walking through the ropes with my chillin'.
She does?
Yes.
Walk through those ropes?
Mm-hmm. As through them as she can get. Depending on how soon they can convince her to go in the other direction. And, you know, it sounds pretty big. You tell them, turn her, or just pull on that rein and make her come back. She'll do it. It's a good thing none of them were there when I was riding her yesterday afternoon. So I got on her, and went out there and walked around a little bit, and I started trotting around. She only does it when she's going in one direction. And all of a sudden, I knew we were in the ropes. And I was doing everything I could, and we were still going into the ropes. And I got her turned around and got her out of them. And tried it around again. This time I was ready for her. I mean, I knew she was going to do it, and I was ready for her. And we still went into the ropes. Well, I cursed at her a little bit, and she didn't seem to hear me, except that she laid her ears back at me. And so I changed my stick. I've been carrying it in my left hand, like you're supposed to, you know. And I changed it to my right hand, and we trotted on, and we got to the spot, and she headed toward the ropes, and I didn't even take my hand off the reins. I just brought that stick against her neck as hard as I could, which wasn't very hard from that sort of angle, but it was hard as I could, and she jumped away from those ropes and just stood there and put her head down and then jumped forward. And she was so mad that as soon as she could, she headed right over. She'd had to get around and get away from one post. And as soon as she could, she went into the ropes again. Just charged into it. I hit her again.
Oh, charged into it this time.
Yeah. And I hit her again, and she got herself away from the ropes. And after that, we just sort of went around and around, and every time she'd start heading toward the rope, I'd tap her on her neck. I didn't have to hit her again. I'd just tap her on her neck, and she'd throw her nose up in the air, but she wouldn't go into the rope. And pretty soon, she stopped doing even that.
Yeah.
And so then Vivian came. I wasn't expecting Vivian that early. I was going to have Vivian ride Hubie. But when she arrived on me like that, I had a horse tacked up that she could ride, so I didn't figure there was any point in wasting a whole lot of time going and get Hubie. So I put her on Pussy, and I told her what I'd done. Said, I don't know what Pussy will do with you, but we'll just go see. And Pussy wasn't too bad. Pussy only went into the ropes about three or four times with her. But she's just, it's a horrible habit she's just gotten into. And she delights in it. She just knows exactly what she can get by with.
For an admirer of Pussy's to say about that mule, but I knew it all the time.
Well, one mustn't be blind to the faults.
Take Missy on the road yesterday?
Yeah, I took her. And she's all right coming back.
Oh.
Well, it was a little bit like there were, I don't know. It's like she was walking on eggshells and afraid they'd break going out. And she had to stop every time she saw something. Not stop completely. She wouldn't just stand still. She'd pretend she was walking. This was what was so infuriating about it. And you'd get after her and she'd trot because she would seem to say, well, after all, I was walking. You obviously want me to trot.
Wait a minute.
There you are. And it's just so annoying when they think, when they pretend that they're doing something and they, you know they know better. And she could be moving 2 inches and just pretend she was walking and not go on. And then she'd trot if you got after her. And I was beginning to wonder, now, Faye can't mean that this horse is all that beautiful and perfect and good. You know, she can't even walk. And we got to the store, and I got the mail, and I came back and got on her, and she started walking out and just put her head down and walked right out all the way back. Didn't stop once. Didn't even look at anything. So I have to say that the abilities there. I love that trip out.
But that's not stubbornness. That's smart, Barbara.
Now, how about that, what Suzanne said about her trotting, Faye? Could you trust Barbara with that?
No. Barbara'd never get that straight. Suzanne was riding Missy out on the road with Barbara, and she had a pad, just the bareback pad on her. And they were walking along. Missy went into a slow trot. Suzanne asked Barbara what she was doing. That she couldn't tell any difference. It was such a smooth trot.
How about that?
Oh, I'll have to admit, she's got a smooth trot. As long as you keep it slow enough. And I might even be forced to admit that her ordinary trot is pretty good. As long as you can keep it active enough. But there are moments when she seems to think that any cue for activity is something to go faster. And we went into canter about 6 times when we weren't supposed to go into canter. And then there was that lead business.
Now, Barbara, this is just because she's been sick. One thing about it, I haven't trusted to put any chow on her because she is a little ticklish, but she won't do anything unless you give her what she thinks is the right signal.
Shake?
She'll just shake, yeah. Like Mrs. Howard, when she wanted her to canter, she just kicked her. And all Missy did was just pull herself in and shake.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't understand that. Barbara, what bridle did you use on Missy?
Well, it wasn't hers. The one I've been using on Pussy.
Barbara Long, she's never had anything on her but her very own bridle. I wish she'd have bucked you.
I don't know. She didn't seem upset.
She just didn't do right. It's not her fault. See what happened? Can't trust anybody around here.
Yeah.
Not even Barbara. She got a bridle made for her. Can't trust anybody. Missy's always been ticklish.
You can't do anything about it. She'll always be that way. She's a bit like a horse I groomed at Tilt. And he was 22 years old. And still, you couldn't touch his flanks. I mean, he just... Grooming was a terror for that horse.
Well, Missy loves to be groomed. She doesn't care what you're doing grooming her. It's just... She flinches a little bit when you hit... She doesn't care, but she just flinches a little bit.
Well, see, Silver would... You'd be going over him with a brush, and then you... or a curry comb, and you'd get back to his flanks and stomach, and he would just sort of curl up. Everybody, you see, he was known for that. There was a man in Jane's Village who had been to the Tilks as a student, I don't know how many years before, 10 or 12 years before, and had known Silver. And when Jane went back and was talking to him, he said, "Is that ticklish horse still there?"
No, Mrs. not like that. You'll see.
It's just something that's rather peculiar to mares, actually. The fact that Silver was ticklish is rather surprising.
Oh.
A lot of mares are ticklish. The weirdest horse I ever worked with was Cassandra. She was a great big buckskin mare and really nice looking. But nobody could get on her. She just couldn't stand to be mounted. And we had a lot of these little quarter horses that were like that, and you just work with them a little while and they get over it. But Verdi said, "Well, Cassandra, this horse has been mounted and ridden. My daughter got on her, had to ride her between pastures and just got on her and rode her. And there was no problem. And yet when you would try to ride her in the ring or get on her up at camp, she would throw a fit. And the only way we could do it was to get three or four of the boys and blindfold her and get her up against a fence. It's the only way you could get on her from the ground. And the only way, if you didn't have a fence and two or three people, the only way you could get on her was to have Jim, the head stable boy, who was a great big strong fella, come throw you up on her. That was the only way you could get up on her. And once you got up on her, she was dead. There was no fight in her once you were on her. And I worked with her. I didn't have time to work with her enough. But I did try. And I never got to first base. I never got any place with her. She just always would start, the minute you put your foot in the stirrup, she was whirling. Just round and round and round and round and round. And she actually picked me up by the end of the rein. She was going so fast, she picked me up, and I was hanging on at the end of the reins with my feet off the ground. She just was whirling that fast, and I didn't want to let go because she would have galloped off. She did that a couple of times, too. She got rid of being galloped off. And one of the stable boys, who's always ridden Western, decided he was the only one that had time for her. And he got Miss Verdi's Western saddle and put it on her and got on her and rode her around, and he never had a bit of trouble mounting her. And he would ride her into the ring and take a look. He'd sit there looking at me, and then he would get off and get on her and get off and get on her and ride off. And I would just
glower
at him.
What do you think, it was the Western saddle?
No. I don't know what it was, because what she seemed to be afraid of was the act of putting your foot in the stirrup,
mm-hmm.
and swinging up. And, of course, in the Western saddle, that was still part of it. And I don't know what he did with her. I know that he had a touch with horses.
Yeah.
And he had time in the evening. See, I didn't.
Mm-hmm.
But
you what?
I didn't have time. I either got on her and got on her fast and rode, or I didn't have time because I had to take care of children and everything else.
You didn't have time to go through a little ceremony.
That's right. I didn't have time to talk to her and coax her into things.
Yeah.
Because I don't know whether he did either. He might have just been lucky. See, sometimes she would forget. and she would just let you get on. He might have been lucky once, and maybe once was all it took if he had enough time to work with her.
Yeah.
See, if you can get on him once and just get on and off and have time to keep doing that, then sometimes that's just the way it takes to break the barrier.
Mm-hmm.
But it was this was what was so funny. Even English, even with us, sometimes, very occasionally, she didn't mind. And it was never, you could never tell when she was going to jump and when she was going to be still.
Mm-hmm.
This is what I always found so weird about her.
Well, you know, Guy, Champ was like that, in a way. You had to mount that horse in a hurry. Once you put your foot in the stirrup, if you didn't go immediately over, he was on his back legs. And I don't know what it was. He was taught to whirl.
I never.
Tuesday afternoon, late November 18th, Suzanne. Tuesday afternoon, late November 18th, Suzanne. Channel 1 right, 180. Channel 1 right, 180. Channel 1 right, 180.
Well, last time we had set it right smart. Anything to add?
Well, when I got home, I started thinking about some of the things I'd said. And I realized what a lot of, I guess I could call my prejudice, had gotten into it with views toward country music. And I didn't really think a whole lot about it because I was working on something else at the time. But it dawned on me that Johnny Cash and Jimmy Dean are both country music, yet it's country music made respectable in a way. It's not, it's more for not just people who normally listen to country music, but a national audience, who type people who listen to regular popular music too.
I tell you, Suzanne, now you are you are just being cautious now, and that's not really adding to the subject. You know, when you're talking out here, you just what you're trying to do is get into the subject. Now, what occurred to me, and we talked about it right smart, it seemed to me like the thing that was lacking, you had plenty of statements about country music, but you got not much information, not much of the experience from down there. Now, what I did was play Barbara's talk on the Debbie and Barnaby, the two cats at the Tilks. It was circumstantial and leisurely experience, and said that's the one thing she learned about all I knew last year, but she never did pick up that business of handling experience, and that she and Jim could get together on it. And idea from last time was just extraordinary, and I'd like to work on it a little bit more. So this is, we didn't really tape, we listened, and this is 210, Channel 1 Right, Suzanne, Tuesday, when she came out to ride and play a little bit on the 18th of November, 69.
Channel 1 Right, 212.
Channel 1 Right, around 212. Channel 1 Right, around 212. And it's Tuesday the 18th of November. It's after supper, evening, on Tuesday the 18th of November.
You said in one of your letters the Tilks were going to retire.
Yeah. Mr. Tilk was already semi-retired all the time I was there. And after Christmas, we had a little, one of those moments at the table when, well, Mr. Tilk had been talking about looking towards the future, Mrs. Tilke had been on to us about being teachers. And then she sort of looked down the table and she said, I guess we better tell them. And Mr. Tilke said, yeah, I guess we better. And so she said, I think you all should know that we are planning to retire. And we are going to sell the school. And she didn't pay any more attention to that. She says, we bought a house out on the other side of Stratford. And Mr. Tilke and I are going to move over there. And we're going to take all the animals and just resettle. And the rest of the conversation was about the house they bought over in on the other side of Stratford. And, of course, after that, we'd known before. They didn't have to tell us. We knew. You can't retire and not show it. But I got a letter from her saying that they had moved and they left Judy and Celia in charge at Windmill Hill, and they had moved to their house over on the other side of Stratford with the four dogs and Debbie, and all had settled in, including Debbie, into their new home. I'm just wondering how Mrs. Tilke feels. All of a sudden becoming just the couple again instead of having an enormous family and all that place. But they left Celia and Judy in charge. And, what was her name? This woman who was been a guest a couple of times. And she was to take care of the house and the student morale. And I have no idea how she would take care of a house, but I can imagine how Celia must be feeling at the moment. Miss Jane Turner, I saw her the first day she came that I saw her. She walked into the school and said, Celia, don't you think that you should do, I forget what it was she wanted her to do. Don't you think that the school should be watered now or something like that? And for the rest of her 2 weeks holiday, it was, Celia, don't you think we should do this? And Celia, don't you think this should be done? Celia would smile. I came up to her one day and said, Celia, how can you stand it? How can you stand having somebody come in and tell you how to run your school? And she says, I can take it for 2 weeks.
For 2 weeks.
I can take it for 2 weeks. And now she's got it for more than 2 weeks.
What kind of house was it?
Well, it was one of these little country cottages like you see hundreds of in England with the bay windows and the nothing interesting about it. I mean, it would be sort of like buying a house here, a ranch-style house here.
Mm-hmm.
It was
just,
yeah, a concrete block house in Florida, here in Florida.
In a subdivision?
Well, no, say it was out in the country.
Oh, was it?
It was out in the country. It was one, you'd see the, you know, the how these have row upon row of these houses. But it was out in the country. And they had about 10 acres, I think, around it. And they were planning, if Celia wanted to continue to stay with them. They were planning to build some stables out in the back for Azzy and Corey, and possibly for a horse that Judy might have. And room for all the dogs and the cats to run and roam and so forth. And for Mrs. Tilk, she said she thought she might do a little gardening now. She hadn't had time to do her own garden.
Uh-huh. What is gardening, does she mean?
Oh, flower garden, mostly, though. She does vegetable garden as well, too. They've always had a garden, but they had a gardener who'd come out every day.
Oh, did they?
Yes.
You haven't told us about it, yeah.
Well, I tell you, I can't even remember his name. He was a little fella who would ride up on his bicycle and wandered around the place looking as if you yelled boo at him, he would jump.
Mm-hmm.
And he would tip his... He wore one of those cloth caps, and he would tip his cap to you and say good morning. And that was it. I mean, you know, you just didn't get in a conversation with him. I never saw anybody but nobody in a conversation with him. And the only person I suppose that could ever get into a conversation with him would have been Mrs. Parker, because she would have caught him in a corner and stood there and talked to him. Talked to him to death. But he would do little chores down around the stable and the gardening up at the house. And Mrs. Tilk would talk, I gathered that he was from one of the villages and had been always been around Stratford. Was from that village, raised in that village, his parents were from that village, et cetera, et cetera. And somehow or other, I picked up something about him, but I've forgotten it now. You know, just one of those things that slipped by from Mrs. Tilk, I think. But nobody talked, he just, it wasn't a person you got in conversation with. He was too shy. He would just back off.
That's the very first person I've heard about over there at the Tilks who didn't talk.
Uh-huh. Well, that's not to say perhaps he wouldn't talk. But he had shy blue eyes. And such a manner that you thought maybe you'd be invading his privacy if you tried to force a conversation on him. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I didn't get in a conversation with him, and since nobody else did, I didn't have any other way of seeing him.
I thought gardeners were always like talky people. But you see, I never known a gardener.
Well, my Welsh gardener was right chatty.
Where did you know him?
I met him for about 15 minutes in Ludlow Common.
Yeah.
And he was a gardener from around Ludlow. And
same kind of gardener?
Mm-hmm. But he was I had the feeling of that he was a man displaced. He had to go to another village to do his gardening. Mm-hmm. And it was right sad. He was walking his dog, and I was in the common, and he said good morning to me, and I said good morning. And that was all the opening he needed. And he started talking about what a beautiful morning was, and I said yes. I said, it's been a beautiful June. And he said, it's been a good month for gardening. I said, oh? He says, yes. So I do a lot of gardening. And we sort of went on for a while. He says, but I can't do any gardening around Ludlow. I said, no. He says, no, I have to go over to some other village to get my gardening, to do my gardening. And now, he told me why he had to go over to this other village. I've forgotten. But it was right sad. Now, I know there are a lot of gardens in Ludlow. But he was caught where he had to travel. He had to leave his own village. Got the feeling that maybe he didn't garden for the same people all the time. Mm-hmm. And the gardener the Tilks had been their gardener for 30 years.
Why, Barbara?
At least I think he had. I don't know for sure, but I know that he'd been doing the gardening there for a long time. And that's the way it is. And my poor little Ludlow gardener not only had to go to another village, but I don't think he's gardened for the same people.
Oh, we never have brought up about Mr. Howes, you know. Who was your Mr. Howes?
Oh, our blacksmith.
Blacksmith.
Yeah, Mr. Worrell. Mr. Worrell was from little village between Stratford and Warwick. Mm-hmm. And he was getting on. And he didn't do most of the horses by the time I got there. And he wouldn't do them right anymore.
Oh.
And he knew so much. And you could listen. He loved to talk. And he would, the highlight of his month, or 2 months, or 3 months, was when he was asked by Celia to give the lectures to the students on riding.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And he could just, he'd come in and he'd plop his shoes down and he said, "Now, girls, I could talk all night." And then he would start off, and some of them would just sit there and think, yeah, he could. and I was always delighted with him. He was fabulous. He couldn't shoe a horse ride anymore. He wouldn't shoe a horse ride anymore. But oh, what he knew.
Yes.
And he would bring out his shoes, and he'd start talking, go into details about how a shoe was made. He'd say, and he'd just get off on this, you see. And the night he gave us our lecture before our exam, he came over at night. Usually he did these things after he'd been shoeing, and he felt that he had to keep them pretty brief. He came over at night after he'd had his supper, and after we'd had our lesson, and he figured he had pretty much time. And he was charging along about, now this is a such and such a shoe. But then he brought out, he started looking at the shoes that he was showing us. And he looked at one of them and says, you know, I made that shoe for my exam. See, the blacksmith takes exams over there. They're apprenticed and they take exams. So I made that shoe for my exam, and I still think it's one of the best shoes I ever made. And he'd show us why. And he'd say, now I can't make a shoe like that anymore. Or I don't have to make a shoe like that anymore. They're old fashioned or something. And he'd get out another shoe and he'd say, now I made this for such and such a fair. And that's a nice piece of work. And he'd look at him, and gleam in his eye, says, but you're not interested in that. And he put them away. And then he got out a bunch of cleats and that you put on the horses, the shoes for the horses, to for ice and so forth. He says, now this is a Mordach stud. And he went into all the, he says, it's made out of what is it? It's made out of hard iron in the center. And he gave the right name for it. I mean, you know. And then the outside of it's softer, so it never wears. And the center doesn't wear as fast as the outside. And then he picked up another one, and he says, but this, you know what this is? No. He says, it's an ice stud.
Ice stud?
Yeah. And he says, you don't see these anymore. You can't get these anymore. But they used to put them on the heavy horses. The horses that were pulling the ice trucks and the milk truck wagons and the horses that never had to go out of a walk but just walked along the road. Says they had these. Well, he also told us what they were used for now. He said they, a lot of people wanted them for open jumpers and for polo. But I like the ice.
Yeah.
Ice. And
well, that was his, he just had a collection.
It was. When he'd go through it. And he could talk about, you know, you talk to a blacksmith here and you start talking about the way a horse's foot is made. And you don't expect him to start talking about Xenophon and the ancient Greeks. But Mr. Worrell was as likely to draw on that as a source for his knowledge and to point out how the Romans shoot a horse as he was to talk about how a horse was shod today.
Mm-hmm.
And you never could tell what was going to come.
Mm-hmm.
He was fascinating.
How do you figure he ever did that?
I don't know when he did that. Except that he said that he liked to read.
Mm-hmm.
And when he was through working, he would read. And what he read on was what he knew.
Mm-hmm.
Was shoeing horses. He may have read on a lot of other things. He might have been able to talk about all sorts of things. But he talked about shoeing horses. To us.
Well, now, you talked to him privately? I mean, when he wasn't lecturing?
No, just a little bit. When he'd stand over the door and I'd be working with a horse and he'd talk about how you're supposed to train a horse. And he'd smile, just smile and listen and nod. Because the way he talked about training the horse was sort of the bluff. You make him listen and you make him obey. And that's it, you know.
Oh, well.
And he just taught. I mean, you know, didn't talk with him much that way. I'm glad to talk about anything, I think. But he knew he was supposed to be talking about shoeing horses, so that's what he talked about.
And he took them a long time, too.
Yes, yeah. He'd been shoeing their horses for... What was he? He told me once when he first started shoeing horses for the tilt. Been at least about 20 years. Well, I don't know. Except I remember when I first got there, I could understand them as long as I was close to them and talking to them like this.
Mm-hmm.
But if they were shouting across the yard or something like that, I couldn't understand them. And I would go to bed thinking in an English accent.
Oh, really?
Just drilling myself in an English accent.
Oh.
Now, I didn't try to speak in an English accent, but I tried to think in one.
Mm-hmm.
And it only took me a little while to pick up the accent. I mean, not to speak it. I did speak with an English accent. I spoke enough with one so that a lot of people would, even when I was first there, would ask whether or not I was American. They knew I wasn't English, but they would ask whether or not I was American. And that wasn't conscious, but
uh-huh.
but the thinking it at night was. And it wasn't because I wanted to speak that way. It's because I wanted to be able to understand what they were talking about.
Uh-huh.
You can coach yourself to speak an accent. But I wasn't trying to do that.
Comes out.
Mm-hmm.
Nice. I
think so.
Yeah.
Now
playing the clarinet.
Playing the man and his wife sitting there playing and he was playing the clarinet, and the wolf sitting between them howling with the clarinet. And they back off, and you have this shot of them just sitting in the grass looking terribly, I don't know whether it would be Garden of Eden or not, this wolf right in the middle of it, and the sun and the sunset in the background.
Wagging his tail.
And wagging his tail and howling with the clarinet.
Wagging his tail. That's the key of it, isn't it?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So you know it's not painful to him. He's
happy.
Singing.
He's singing.
Now that was that television program, The Wolfman, the study of the wolves.
Do you think Brother Hyman kind of brought helped it a little bit with the that thing I asked you, the Garden of Eden idea in the school?
I don't know. I get the feeling that he does a lovely job of proving something that's not there. If you can prove something perfectly and it still not be there, I think he does it. I may be wrong. I mean, he keeps saying he doesn't want to overlabor his point, and then he proceeds to go on to something even further. But right, all the language is there.
Yes.
And the Garden of Eden idea does fit the language. And in that, you can't say it's not there, because he does it beautifully. Just shows you it's there. And yet after you get through, I still think he's wrong.
I forget some of the details he brings out. Bly, even Bly would be.
Yeah, would be the garden. It's because of the way it's this golden sky and the what would be the perfect world for her perfect children when they grew up would be an extension of Bly, of the garden of Bly. And in themselves are perfectly beautiful, and they're described as bright and
golden.
I don't know, that's not one of the words, but luminous is how he describes it.
Luminous?
Mm-hmm.
I've forgotten. What connection?
Well, he's talking about the children as being symbolic of primeval man. And he he says he goes from the fact that the children are described as bright and light coming from their faces and all this to their being fresh, and then he says that this is this brings to mind the freshness and purity of first beginnings of the beginning, and that therefore the children are symbolic of
suggests that. They suggest it.
Suggest it, yeah.
He doesn't have symbol. But evil is in it too, and that other alternate question I put up on going.
Yeah, the duality.
I kind of, how does he work that out? I kind of forget.
He says that, the fact that the children are corrupted by evil, and that by having this, James is studying the old problem of the duality of man, and that the children actually do try to hide things, to deceive the governess, and that she is engaged in a struggle of good against evil.
And evil is present, and the sense of evil is always there.
Words that he uses.
Most of the language.
Which,
yeah.
What clicked with me actually was not anything Cargill said. Because he was. It's not that I think he said. Maybe he did say it, but I missed it. But he sees Alice and the Freudian case as sort of a background experiences which. James drew on, and he talks about the fraud, the symptoms of the case as things that he drew on, like the book that Alice says she couldn't read a book because that was at all suggestive because it would excite her too much,
mm-hmm.
and she'd have to put it down, and he says, well, you draw parallel with this from the governess, and says that James got the idea for the governess from
the
Alice.
Book. Yeah, from the book.
But I think even more than that, Alice, the little bits of her journal that they show, she can look back so clearly. And she sees, for instance, when she's talking about sitting in the room and having to hold herself from going over and hitting her father. And yet when she writes that, she sees it so clearly. And that's what the parallel I saw between her and the governess.
What did it say? That she herself felt that she was the executioner.
Yes.
And also somebody stay in the hand of the executioner. That's not it at all.
She says she's the prisoner and the jailer.
Yeah.
That she's jailer at the same time she's the prisoner.
That's remarkable. So in that, he got the governess's control?
I think so.
I mean, that's what...
Yeah.
Yes, that's fine.
I don't know whether Cargill said that or not. That's what I had to get from it.
Mm-hmm. That's nice.
know, that's just amazing, because the attitude in that, it's you don't know when it's the 20-year-old governess and when it's the older governess.
Well, I had I haven't tried to work that out, quite frankly, yet.
Well, I wouldn't try to work it all out.
Well, I don't mean work it out.
I
see the point. I couldn't, if you asked me to show you where, just to pick up one point where I thought she was the governess looking back, I might have a hard time just thinking up something to show you. I have to,
Oh, no.
You know.
It's that's clear all through the hallucination section. I picked out the most obvious case, where she recaptures what happened with Peter Quint.
And about the two shocks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the others, I just picked out an obvious one.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you can find that.
Well, yeah, I suppose so.
And
I
then
don't
you
know. It's
yes. It just ignores the plot and the hallucinations and all those things. Gets down to a point of language almost.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I suppose it is. And that's that is.
Mm-hmm. And if they read more than one, then they can understand that there's different ways.
Different dad.
Yeah.
A revelation.
Yeah. Now that's the end of the talk after supper on Tuesday the 18th of November 69. Now that's the talk after supper. We start off with Tilks retiring. I don't know. Got into that some way or other. And then just came up the gardener at the Tilk and then the blacksmith. Then we sort of shifted over into what we'd been talking about at the in the office today, the articles on the turn of the screw. On 7:15, channel 1 right, 7:15, channel 1 right, on Barbara's Reel 3. Well, that's up about bedtime, Tuesday the 18th of November, 69. Now, this is Wednesday morning. Time to go in. Faye to go in, and they've been out working a little bit with Missy. The astronauts have been walking on the moon on this Apollo 12 shot. They got there at 1 a.m., but they didn't come out and start walking until almost breakfast time. So when we came down to breakfast, they were on, except their television camera didn't work. This is Channel 1 right, 7:30, Channel 1 right. 7:30. We just came in from working with the horses, huh? That little taunt. Faye is sitting on a bale of hay. Comfortable this morning. Balmy again. While we wait for another cold spell. We started off out there then with that little taunt when Barbara came out there.
Well, I don't know. All I did was ask her if she minded if I used something besides Missy's bridle.
Flinched,
yeah. She said, well, she won't obey you.
No wonder she doesn't obey you.
I sort of said, and reached in and got hold of the other bridle.
Saying that you were too lazy to come to the house and get Mrs.?
That's right. Just too doggone lazy to be to bother. She didn't seem to mind. I think she did right well.
Threw the saddle on the off side.
Well, I just do what's most convenient, Faye. Just do what's most convenient. Mr. Tilk used to say that if you followed the book too closely, so that it made it harder work,
It was a sign of a sign of an amateur.
That's wonderful.
Some new wind to break the rules to make it easier for everybody around. I put a saddle on the off side a lot. It happens to be the closest side to me.
What about mounting?
Mount on the off side too. It's closest side to me. We had to do that. We had to do it fast. See, you would line us up and say, all right, change horses. And you get off on one side and get on the other, whichever side is close to you.
Mm-hmm.
That was so that we could be able to do that fast in case of an emergency or something like that. Exam.
Road miss it. What seemed to be the thing you need to work with the most?
To me, Bob, when you left over there, you had a plan of action. And your scheming little head.
I wouldn't know that it was a plan of action, exactly. I wanted to just sort of loosen her up. Because the last time I rode her, I knew she was stiff. Because she hadn't been working much. And it's a little bit like riding a board that bends the wrong way on the corners or something. I don't know. She got out there and we started walking around. She wouldn't walk. She just can't walk out yet. And so
she can't what?
Walk out yet. Take long strides while she's walking.
Yeah. Fast walk.
Not fast, just long strides. She can't do it yet. And it needs to be a little faster than she's doing. She feels like she's only moving about 2 inches forward each time she takes a step. Mm-hmm. And so I put her into a trot and let her trot around. And doggone if she didn't start off with her head up in the air. Right up in the air. Just felt as if she was, I don't know what, it's a feeling difficult to describe. They call it getting above the bit. And it's when the horse seems to forget that there's a bit in his mouth and sticks his head right up in the air.
Really?
And moves along, and you can feel you can't do anything with them when they bit like that.
That's because of that bit you had on them.
No, it wasn't because of the bit. The other bit would have been worse.
Wouldn't have.
With a long shanks on that bit. She would really toss her nose around. She settled. Didn't take her long. And I sort of worked with her on lengthening her strides at trot. You know, you go down around the short side and you just let her trot her little short trot. And then on the long side, you get her to trot long strides. So she can do 20 strides around the short end and 8, 9 down the sides, and it's the same distance.
Really?
That's what she did.
Hmm.
Anywhere between 15 and 20 strides on the short, around the short end and 9 down the long side. That's the difference you can make in a horse's stride.
Do you know that thing?
I hadn't thought about it being double.
Yeah, it doubled.
More than double.
No, that was deliberate. That wasn't you know, sort of. She could do 15 down the side, too.
Mm-hmm.
But you get a push around. Yep. In order to do that.
Uh-huh.
But after we'd done that for a little bit, I started working on circles. And Pussy can do ever so much better.
On circles.
Mm-hmm. Pussy just looks in the direction she's going and bends her back. She's terribly supple for a horse.
Pussy?
Mm-hmm. Considering her build and everything, she's terribly supple. Of course, she's had it's not fair on Missy, you know, but because she hadn't been worked, but after Pussy, she sure did feel stiff. And on those circles, you see, she'd go around with her head on, looking the opposite direction from the direction she was going. And when they do that, they fall in. and the circle keeps getting smaller and gets sort of sled-sided instead of round. And I just had to be satisfied when I could get her to look just every once in a while to bend properly. And praise her for that and forget the rest.
Well, now she needs to be worked in this because she can do it.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure she can do it. Right at the moment,
yeah,
she's a stiff little girl.
But she didn't go into any ropes.
Well, no.
What
no,
happened?
There was a moment there when you fight the car by the side of the ring that I had a distinct feeling I had lost her attention. I don't know what gave me that feeling. It could be the fact that we kept stopping down at that end.
She's a polite horse.
Yes, well, polite to whom? Polite to you, I guess. Maybe she saw her bridle in that car.
Yeah. Now, how'd you figure just neck reining her all the time?
She didn't care. I was rather hoping that would encourage her to put her head down and follow the bit a bit more. It didn't have any remarkable results, but it was a nice idea. I just wanted to just stretch. She'd get all tense and come up like that, and she wouldn't walk out, and I figured maybe trotting her on a long rein would help her. And then it just seemed to be too much trouble on a long rein to have to guide her normally, and it's a lot easier to neck rein that way, so
uh-huh.
She would do it, I'd do it.
Yeah.
And her canter, oh, it's about the same. I mean, it's you know when she took up the wrong lead with me?
Uh-huh.
You know which signal I was giving her?
Outside rein, inside knee, leg, I guess.
Uh-uh.
What were you doing?
Inside rein, inside leg. That's when she was doing it right.
Uh-huh.
When she did it wrong, it was outside
rein.
That's
what I thought. Uh-huh.
Outside rein. I don't know why. Because if she's been trained, like you say, to be outside rein, inside leg, then she should have done it for me.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't, maybe she was just, oh, who knows what it is. Maybe she's just stiff and wouldn't have picked up right, given the correct signals.
Now, what they use at Blake's, what Claudia will tell you, is that they say rein toward the fence. Rein toward the fence and lean inside.
Now, that's the end of the visit, the talk about the horses. Wednesday morning, the 19th of November, 69. And this is the end of Channel 1 Right. End of Channel 1 Right. This is the end of Channel 1 Right. And talk of the horses about Missy, working Missy, on Wednesday, the 19th of...